एचडी स्मार्ट कास्ट।
यू आर लिसनिंग टू एन एचडी स्मार्ट कास्ट ओरिजिनल।
एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। We meet some of the most celebrated startup founders in the country.
And we want to learn how to build a unicorn.
Hi, I'm Sachin Bhatia. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Bulbul, India's first video shopping app.
We have been familiar with the boon of online shopping for quite some time now. And we don't see ourselves stopping anytime soon. However, what if this online experience was redefined in a way that helps you not only to understand the product better, but also gives you a real-time demonstration about what you're buying? Sachin Bhatia has made the shopping experience refined, reliable, and efficient by live streaming in a language that completely suits you. His company Bulbul has only been in the market for a couple of years, but it has most certainly made a bold mark in the industry, all thanks to Sachin's vision. This time on Founder Thesis, we have Akshay Dutt in conversation with the founder of Bulbul, Sachin Bhatia. Tune in.
You studied in DPS Arkapuram, right?
That's right.
So, what was that experience like? I mean, I'm a DPS Arkapuram product myself, and I know that it's like a...
Unfortunate.
Crowd.
Yeah, school was cool. Yeah. I mean, I personally don't have... I mean, I have fond memories of school. I think, you have friends and I'm still... My closest friends are still my buddies from school. Got up to a lot of mischief, studied a bit, had some fun. But when I look back or when I look at the kind of schools my kids have had the opportunity to go to, it could have been so much better, right? One reflection of like a really good school is the Alumni Association that a school has, and since you're from DPS, I don't know how it is now, but we never have a strong alumni. I'm in touch with 4 or 5 of my school friends, but that's because we were friends in school, so there's no opportunity to kind of connect. And I think that's just a reflection of the kind of school it is.
Okay. And you had science in your plus two, or what did you take?
No, I did commerce. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in DPS, my personal experience is like maybe 10% of the kids there have like a really good experience in terms of participating in debates or whatever. And the remaining 90% just like get by. So were you in that 10% category or in the 90% category?
I was, at the cost of sounding boastful, in the 10% category. So I was part of the quizzing team. I was part of the dramatics team. I was in, I don't know if they still have it and if they continue with it, which was a very classist system of labeling sections by ability. So I was in the abilities section in commerce.
Yeah.
And my friends were in semi-abilities, and then there were some friends in non-ability. And that's how it was called. It was like officially called. It wasn't like, it was officially known as that, which of course wouldn't pass muster today in these politically correct times, but that's what it was. But I think the good thing is one didn't it didn't stop us from mingling with each other, right? Actually, some people used to wear it as a badge of honor that they were in a semi-ability or a non-ability section. I was in the 10%.
So academics was not what drove you. It was like more non-academic kind of stuff.
Like
you wanted to work with people rather than sit and study.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was also a function of what I studied. So I think I would have been happier if I had taken, political science, history, which was called arts and which was obviously at that time totally looked down upon and probably... But I think if I had taken arts, I would have been I would have been much happier, I think, because that's what kind of comes to me naturally. If I look at my reading habits today or for the past many, many years, the kind of stuff that I read either history, if it's fiction, it's historical fiction, it's politics, it's economics, things like that. But I think one never had that sense you know, at that point in time. So obviously many, many years ago. But yeah, I think if I'd taken arts, I would have been happier. So yeah, it was a function of my choice also that I wasn't particularly thrilled doing accounting.
So how did your mother influence you as a child? And I read somewhere that at the age of 12, you were helping her in her business.
Wow, where did you get that? you've obviously done deep research. No, yeah, that's true. I think I've always seen my mother work. And obviously, everyone expects their dads to work. But and this too back then, right? I passed out of school in 1990, so I'm 48 today. Even back then, right from my childhood, I saw my mother work, get up in the morning, take a bus, go to Connaught Place to deliver flowers or to do flower arrangements in office, etc. But she always came back before we kind of got back from school, right? So I think that was a really a good balance because she was away when me and my sister were away at school, and 9 out of 10 times I guess she was back before we were back or when we were back. But I always saw her working, right? And then I started helping her on the side on the weekends when I could start driving. I was doing some deliveries for her. Not hard stuff, honestly. It wasn't like labor, but it does give you a sense of responsibility very early on. It does showcase that hard work can kind of help you better your own life and the life of your family and people around you. So tons of love. And she still works, which is amazing, right? She's in her late 60s now, and she's still at it. And now she, of course, does weddings and things like that, which require her to stand on her feet, supervise stuff. But she still does it. She loves what she does. And that's the other big learning. I think she never looked at it as a job. I said she used to come back on time to be with us. And a lot of her clients are her friends. She genuinely enjoys what she does, which very few of us are kind of privileged to experience. So I think that's a big takeaway for me.
So what were you thinking as a kid, that you'll also be an entrepreneur as you saw your parents, or did you want to get a good job? What was the plan at that time?
Yeah, honestly, I don't think I had a plan. I mean, I can make up a nice story around it. But, that time, I don't think entrepreneurship even was a word. You were either a businessman, or you were in service, or you were in the forces, or you were a doctor, lawyer, professional, whatever. Right? Honestly, didn't look at it that way. Even my dad obviously became an entrepreneur much later in life. But, it was a very different kind of entrepreneurship, right? What he did. It wasn't like today. It wasn't about startups. It wasn't cool. It was a way of kind of making a living. So I don't think any of that kind of inspired me from that perspective. I guess I just wanted to finish school. The idea was that I'll do BCom, do an MBA, and then figure out what happened. But I think there's some things get instilled in you very early on. And I think being responsible for yourself, being in control of stuff, and the desire to kind of work for yourself. I think all of those kind of got ingrained fairly early on. I mean, this is now when I look back, right? Obviously, didn't experience or feel a lot of this when I was growing up. So I don't think I had any specific kind of ambitions. I guess I always knew I wanted to do well. I always knew I wanted to work hard. I think those things were clearer in my mind. And those things I remember, thinking of that or discussing those things with friends or family or whatever.
So where did you do your BCom from?
I did it from Bhagat Singh College, South Campus.
Okay, so that must have been fun. I mean, Bhagat Singh has this reputation of being a party college, South Delhi and all that.
Yeah, my uncle used to call it Hoodlum College. So he thought all hoodlums came from Bhagat Singh, which wasn't true because it had a really good BCom program. We used to like saying that, hey, it's number two after SRCC. I don't know if it's true or not, but at least we like to believe that. But it genuinely had some really good profs for BCom. But yeah, college was, similar. It wasn't intense. It was, fun kind of 3 years. You played a lot, played a lot of sport. I mean, off campus, not for the college team as such, but, just your cricket, soccer, etc. Went to college, came back. It was just in a way, it was a waste of time, but it's time. It's that time of your life that you can probably afford to waste, right? So no complaints on college. I think I started getting very serious after that. I immediately started working after college because by then I had this desire to be on my own. Earn money. My friends were doing their MBAs. I thought I'll do it probably a little later. But that college was, that's how college was.
So that must have been around 93, I guess. 90, you finished school. So by 93, you would have...
Yeah, 93, 94. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So what was your first job? And, you know, tell me about the career path.
Yeah, so I joined as a sales executive in a company called Newcomware. Newcomb were among the first guys to start providing bottled water, the large bottle which you see now inverted over your water coolers. It was a new, totally new concept for India at that point in time. So there was a brand called Hello, I remember, and there was us. It was called Crystal with a K. It was a Faridabad-based company. So they, you know, gave an ad in the paper or something, and I went for the interview to Faridabad, and I kind of got in. And I think it was, again, now when I look back, probably the challenge of something new and novel. It wasn't just like any other sales job because, you know, nobody was buying water that time, right? It was like a crazy thing to sell. I remember going to these factory owners in Faridabad because that was my beat in the early days. And they said, ki yaar, aap pani bech rahe ho, kal hawa bhi bechne aaoge humare ko. That was pretty much, so it was more like a concept sell. It wasn't just, hey, buy this water, it's the cheapest in the market or it's the best quality. It was, you know, selling them hygiene, selling them cleanliness, selling them convenience, you know, bunch of things before you even got down to talking about the product and the process and the reverse osmosis and all the cool stuff. So I think those are the kind of things which have, you know, always, I guess, attracted me, something which is new, something which is novel. And yeah, so that was my first job. I did that for a few months. Then I got promoted, you know, and they shifted me to Delhi. So I worked there for more than a year. That was my first job.
Okay. Then what next?
Then I joined Wiscraft, which was an events management agency. I wanted to do something different. I think I was still figuring out what I really wanted to do, right? I was in two minds. I'd put in a year and a half at Newcomb. I think maybe there was pressure to do an MBA from the family. I still liked getting that paycheck at the end of the month. I bought myself a bullet, so had expensive taste for that time. I didn't want to, I think, give up on that. So I joined Wiscraft and I worked there for some time. It was a fairly short stint, but I think the exciting part of that stint was that they used to manage a nightclub in Gurgaon. And that time Gurgaon was really back of beyond, and it was called Fireball. It was probably India's fanciest nightclub. And I think even today, India probably hasn't had a nightclub like that. It was huge, based on the Star Wars theme. You entered through Darth Vader's mouth. It was pretty crazy stuff. So I used to kind of get to work there and hang out there as part of my job. So I did that for 6-7 months, but that was just pure fun, right? That was just, you know, like chilling between jobs kind of thing. And then I think I finally got serious, decided that, hey, I've done sales. Marketing is something that, you know, naturally kind of comes to me, appeals to me. And I didn't have a theoretical grounding in marketing. And I figured that maybe I need to join advertising to understand marketing a little bit more. So I worked at, I got a job at Grey Advertising, which was Trikaya Grey that time. I worked there for 2 years, put in a year in Delhi, put in another year in Bombay. Which again, you know, I consciously chose to kind of move to Bombay just to get more exposure. And Bombay really was the heart of the advertising industry. Delhi was still a little, old fashioned when it came to advertising. All the magic was happening in Bombay. So managed to connect.
You were doing client servicing there?
I was doing client servicing. Luckily, Trikai was one of the few agencies which had a lot of divisions. So I got to work in, except I think PR, I pretty much worked in direct marketing. I worked in financial advertising. I worked in regular brand advertising. I worked in events. I did a lot of work in events, so got some fairly rigorous exposure there on the ground stuff, outdoors. So managed to put in 2 years, but got a lot out of that stint. And then I joined AMF Bowling, which was where I met Deep, Deep Kalra, and then make my trip.
So Deep was the promoter of AMF or like?
No, he was AMF was is an American company, and Deep was heading AMF in India, and I was looking at moving back from Bombay. I'd done 2 years at Trikaya. I figured I'd learned whatever I had to learn in advertising and realized it. I mean, it's not a career I wanted to make. I mean, I wasn't happy just servicing clients. I wanted to be more in control. So I thought I'll work on the brand side. But, you know, I didn't have like a classic, you know, MBA, etc. So obviously, I'm sure I applied to a lot of FMCGs and guys like that. And I'm sure they don't probably never even called me for an interview. But, you know, Deep was obviously, you know, we both enjoyed kind of discussing stuff when we met. And I joined AMF as marketing manager back then. So we used to set up bowling centers. So, yeah, that's how I met Deep. And then.
And what was your learning from the AMF stint? Like AMF eventually didn't really continue. Like, is it still around? Or
I mean, the American entity is around. I think, see, again, if you see AMF, you know, bowling is something totally unique, something totally different. I, you know, probably seen bowling in a movie or two. I myself didn't know much about it. And this is pre kind of Google days. So information wasn't so readily available. But whatever I could read.
This was, I think, probably the time when pool was also like a big craze.
It just about. I think bowling came first. And maybe pool came together, but pool maybe came like a few months later, literally, right? Typically, bowling and pool go hand in hand because the companies which make both the equipments are the same, at least in the US and then in China. So AMF was very interesting. I think that's where I got exposed to working with, I mean, at Trikaya, I'd obviously worked with fairly big brands. Done a lot of product launches, etc. But at AMF, I could, you know, I wasn't just a consultant. I wasn't just a client servicing person. I was responsible to implement stuff. But given that budgets were fairly tight, it required one to work with, you know, a lot of sponsors, right? So I worked with Coca-Cola very closely. I worked with Pepsi. So that gave me insights into how big, bigger brands work, how they think, how they look at advertising, how they look at, you know, spending money across different media.
So what were you doing with Pepsi and Coke?
Yeah, so at AMF, see, you a bowling center is not only about the sport, if you can call bowling a sport, but it's also about all the fun and entertainment, right? So the food, beverage, all of that. And then you have all these leagues which amateurs can kind of participate in. You need sponsors for those leagues. You need prizes. So I think the big thing was bowling was supposed to be the next big thing in India. Unfortunately, I think people didn't realize that real estate is extremely expensive in India, right? In the cities, unlike in the US where bowling centers are a little away from the city, but then driving is not a problem. People can easily drive. That doesn't exist in India, right? So that's why you don't have big Walmarts or whatever here too. But I guess we were too young and naive to kind of realize that. So real estate was very expensive, but, you know, there were some, you know, optimistic businessmen who set up really large centers in India. We set up like a huge 20-lane center, which was the biggest one in Bombay, where Lower Parel is today. We set up a largish bowling center at Essex Farms. We set up one at 32nd Milestone. So all over the country. Pepsi, Coke, all these guys were sponsors. So they used to get rights for the beverage. Because people consume a lot of beverage while playing bowling, right? Whether it's beer or soft drinks or whatever. So, yeah, worked fairly closely with their kind of marketing teams back then. So, yeah.
And what was your impression of Deep back then when you were reporting to him at AMF?
Yeah, Deep's obviously super smart, super impressive, very, very analytical, and he's still the same and extremely enthusiastic, I think, about work and what he does. And that hasn't diminished even one bit. So I think my impression of him, what it was probably on day one, which was, you know, I think now 12 years ago, hasn't really kind of changed. Yeah, so still the same.
So how did the exit from AMF and the move into MMT happen?
Yeah, so Deep left. I was still at AMF when Deep left. He left to join G, and I was still at AMF then. And then Deep left G to start Make My Trip. I was, you know, I'd done 2 years at AMF, and I was looking at, and I realized AMF was a nice, small, little thing. Probably won't scale beyond that. But I'd, done my bit. I'd learned whatever I had to learn. It was time to move on. And I was doing a part-time MBA then. So I think that had also kind of culminated. So I didn't have a big degree with me. But, whatever theoretical stuff I needed, I think I kind of had that. So I actually approached Deep for a ref check. I was applying to a few places, and then I knew he's doing something on his own. I knew it's in travel. I wasn't entirely sure what it is, because we generally, kind of kept in touch. And so then I went to meet him. I remember in Okhla, told him, hey, I'm moving on, and I just want a ref check, blah, blah, blah. And then he said, hey, this is what I'm doing. We're looking at somebody to head marketing. Why don't you consider this? So, because it was it was something totally new, exciting. I didn't even know much about the internet, how it worked. None of us did, honestly, back then. It seemed like extremely, extremely exciting to me. Didn't realize it would be like a 10-year journey. But that was pretty much how it started. So I went to actually ask him for a reference, and ended up joining him.
Mm-hmm. You joined as a co-founder with Equity and Zero Salary, or?
No. So Deep was the sole founder of the company. I joined, I think the company was incorporated on the 1st of April 2000. I joined in June, and Keyur, who was our third co-founder, joined April. I think he joined maybe in May or something. So maybe a month after the company started. So Keyur joined as head of sales. I joined as head of marketing. But then, all sorts of stuff happened. The dot-com bust and investors kind of going off, etc. So we then kind of got designated as co-founders, because we were the only guys among the senior management who stayed on. Rest of the guys bailed or moved on or whatever. We were still bullish on the business. And then we got designated, and we got a little bit of equity for that. So yeah, we were not original founders or co-founders. We were kind of designated co-founders, which is kind of sexy to do now. And kind of fashionable, but I don't think it was like the thing back then. But yeah, fortunately, that's how it panned out.
So when you joined, how long after that did the first fundraise happen? Because I assume it would have taken a long time for it to become cash flow positive. So, how did you sustain in those initial years? Was it Deep putting in his savings, or, how are you getting a salary?
No, so Deep got funded pretty much on day one. Deep had already raised money, $2 million back then. So we already had money, but I think we went through that money, over a period of time, say 1 year or so. But then the dot-com bust happened, right? So there was more money to come in from our investors, which was eVentures. But the investors themselves kind of shut shop in India, right? We sustained on internal accruals there. After that, obviously, everyone took cuts. We came down to, I think, 20 people from 40, 45 people. A lot of them got soft landing in a company called eBookers, which we helped set up. Deep, rather, I wasn't involved really. Deep helped set up a call center for them. And a lot of our senior executives kind of got a soft landing there. And we got some money for that to kind of help set up. They took over some of our assets and things like that. And then we, kind of rebuild the company from scratch.
So in what sense do you mean rebuild? What was it previously, and how did you rebuild it? Like, tell me about those early years,
Okay, so when we started, we were looking at doing everything in travel, right? So we said we'll do inbound, we'll do outbound, we'll do domestic. And one small part of the business was looking at NRIs traveling back home. But I think very quickly we realized that India still wasn't ready for the net. Credit card penetration was low, internet connectivity was poor. There were hardly any low-cost carriers that time. So there was hardly anything. There were no low-cost carriers that time. There was hardly any airlines. So there was hardly anything to really sell. So we realized that if you want to, stay. And we were obviously hopeful that all of this will improve over time. We were just not sure by when. Hmm. So one small part of the business was NRIs coming back home. So we said, hey, let's focus on that and let's see when the markets change. And we actually ran that for 5 years, right? So for 5 years, we just ran NRIs traveling back from the US to India. Actually turned the company into a you know, we used to break even, actually make a little bit of profit. And we were just waiting it out, right? But, you know, that's the time we build the muscle on running a call center, running customer service, understanding travel technology, understanding travel, you know, in its entirety. Except Keyur, who had a short stint in travel before Make My Trip. None of us were from travel, you know, or even tech, right? Deep is not a techie, neither am I, nor was Keyur. So I think that 5 years was a fairly interesting learning curve. And also, we were very young, right? So we also kind of developed as managers, leaders, leading teams, leading products, etc. So I think utilized those the 5 years for that. And then in 2005, things, you know, started to change. Low-cost carriers got launched, credit card penetration increased, internet became a little more robust. And that's when we said, hey, now is the time to actually relook at India and launch for the Indian consumer. And then, you know, since we had the experience, since we had the team, we had the infrastructure, that's when VC started getting interested in the market and in us specifically. And we got funded in 2005.
First 5 years was essentially you were targeting people in US who want to travel to India, and you were like helping them to buy tickets, airline tickets.
Yeah, NRIs, mostly NRIs. We had some cost arbitrage and we had a time arbitrage. I think the big thing was that when US travel agents were shut, we had a 1-800 number from the US to India. Probably one of the first guys to kind of set it up. And we used to answer their calls in the night here, right? So day or night, we used to be on 24/7. So when it was night there, that's when we were really useful for them. Because, you know, there were techies, there were people, who professionals in the US. They would come back from work, look at options to fly back to India, look at our website, you know, and it was an expensive purchase. So yeah, they would call us up.
How did you get leads? I imagine it, you would have to spend money to get leads, especially American leads. Like, did you have the funds to do that? Or, you know, how was it?
Yeah, we used to market in the US. Yeah. So we used to do a lot of hacky stuff back then. We obviously didn't have a lot of money, and performance marketing didn't really exist back then. But I used to tie up, for example, with a lot of universities there. Each university has an Indian club, right? So I used to email them, get in touch with them, tell them about us. Used to hire brand ambassadors. We used to call them campus gurus, which is like thing today to do for any startup targeting young people in India. So we used to do it back then, but remotely, right? So I never even traveled to the, I'd never even gone to the US. So used to do that remotely sitting here. Google used to be fairly slow, but used to search for, you know, made a list of universities, search for their India clubs, write to them, sponsor events over there. There were some India specific magazines we used to advertise. And so, you know, small stuff, but we were pretty much the only game in town, right, for them. And that, so there was a lot of virality around what we did, because I think the one thing we were very clear about was offering great customer service, right? And I think that endeared us to these customers, and they kept coming back.
And how did things change post 2005 once you had the fundraise?
Yeah, so then I think it was a all new kind of ball game, because then we were targeting India, and as soon as we got funded, within the next few months, competition also kind of got funded, or competition kind of came about.
There was Yatra,
ClearTrip. So within 3-5 months of us launching, these guys also launched. That was a whole new ballgame. Yeah, much bigger market, so much more to do. We had some money, so we could spend on advertising. We could set up bigger call centers, you know, hire more people. And then obviously look at stuff beyond air tickets, because the US-India business was an air ticket heavy business. There was some inbound tours we, you know, tried to do just to understand how hotel bookings work, etc. So that knowledge came in handy, started selling holidays, started selling hotels. But that happened much later. I think the initial few years after 2005 was still predominantly air ticketing based.
Mm-hmm.
And that time, tickets were still written by hand. They were not e-tickets. So, you know, just setting up ops to kind of manage that, it was pretty interesting, yeah.
So how did the ticket reach the person? Was it like sent by post? Or?
Post, yeah. Courier.
Okay. Hard to imagine today.
Yes, it was all by courier. Actually, I think the day we launched in October of 2005, you know, we got overwhelmed. We never expected to sell so many tickets. We thought we'll sell a few. And we obviously had our call center agents who were sitting ready to kind of write tickets. But, you know, India hadn't seen this before. It was super convenient. Things worked very well online. and people started buying. And then we had to, at least all of us, I remember, we used to sit in the night, write tickets, and we obviously missed a lot of it. People never got their tickets on time. Travel was the next day. So went through all that pain. But I guess that's what you do for a new product, new market, you know, come out better for it.
And what was your role by the time you quit? Like, you were head?
Yeah, so I ran marketing I ran marketing throughout till around 2008. So from 2000-2005, I ran marketing, also some part of tech in terms of website development, etc. Then from 2005 till 2008, I ran marketing completely. And then 2008 to 2010, I ran new products. So I ran all the non-air, non-hotel, non-holidays launches. So train launch, rail launch, cars, car bookings, mobile, whatever little was happening on mobile back then, reviews and ratings. So all the new stuff, I kind of got it off the ground.
So that sounds like an exciting kind of a role, no? Why did you leave? I mean, launching new stuff is like what anybody with entrepreneurial streak would want.
Yeah, so I think you have a far more flexibility of working on new stuff when you're not a public listed company, and especially not a NASDAQ listed company. I think then things kind of change. And I realized that the company had obviously become super big, and I'd kind of contributed, done whatever I could do. And, you know, like I jokingly say, you know, how many tickets can you sell, right? Of course, that's not true, because Deep and Rajesh are still, they continue to do what they were doing, just at a massive, you know, gigantic kind of scale. But I think I'd done enough in travel. I think 10 years is more than enough. And it was time to, we had IPO'd. There was honestly nothing I felt I could change for the company. I mean, I could keep doing newer stuff. I could optimize stuff which is existing. But I don't think it was, personally for me, it wasn't exciting anymore. I wanted to kind of move on, do other things. So
you felt that you were not making enough of an impact.
Absolutely. So I think my days of impact, at least the way I looked at it back then, were kind of over. I mean, I could have stepped back, you know, reconsidered, done probably a bunch of things, and then Make My Trip obviously did a lot of stuff. But if you look at the period from IPO for the next couple of years, it was more about consolidation, right? It was just improving, optimizing, bettering what they had achieved. There was nothing dramatically new that was happening. So I think in hindsight, it seemed like a good decision, because from a personality perspective, I need to do, you know, new exciting stuff, work with smaller teams. I think at least back then, that's the way I used to think.
So you quit post the listing?
I actually quit a couple of months before the listing.
Okay.
We knew the listing's happening in August. I quit in March or something, I think, for 3-4 months before listing. But I was there. I was there at...
Get pressure to stick around?
Once I decided, then I think listing was just a milestone. I knew I'll be invited for the listing on NASDAQ, which I was. So there was nothing I could have kind of changed in those 3-4 months, right? So, you know, once I decided, I kind of moved on. But I was there with Deep and Rajesh and Keur at the Bell on NASDAQ. So that was exciting. I mean, that's I think a once in a lifetime opportunity, and was fortunate enough to be part of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So 2010, you are now like without a regular 9-to-5 thing to do. So what did you do then?
Yeah, so I can candidly say one of the mistakes. I mean, I think I put a lot of pressure on myself, and I tell a lot of younger entrepreneurs who've either exited or looking at exit, I put a lot of pressure on myself to start something very quickly, right? And there was no pressure, right, from anyone, not from my family or my peers, or, you know, I wasn't a public figure where people were waiting with bated breath that, what is Sachin Bhatia going to do next? You know, there was none of that. I think it was just a needless self-inflicted kind of pressure that, hey, I must, I'm still young. I need to get on with stuff. One of the things I was very passionate about, even at Make My Trip, was the outdoors. I do a lot of rafting, climbing, etc. And I always felt that there is a space for, you know, folks who want a slightly more luxurious outdoor experience. Who don't want to stay in tents on the Ganges or wherever they raft, who want to do a day's work in the outdoors, but then come back to you know, an air-conditioned room, a hot bath, nothing very fancy, but basics. So I kind of kept, you know, when I was at McMetrip also, I used to do a lot of, like I said, outdoor stuff. But that's what I felt. So I actually tied up with somebody I knew well to set up India's first what we called an active hotel, which was an activity-based hotel, where, you know, the idea was to offer a bunch of outdoor activities through the day, but you came back to like a resortish kind of place. So I did that. I set that up from scratch for 2 years, but that kind of didn't really pan out well. I mean, we set up something very spectacular. It got covered in probably every travel magazine in the country and even overseas. I ran that for a few months, but I think that partnership wasn't meant to be. So decided to kind of move out of that. You know, obviously learned a lot. I'd never done construction myself. I mean, not physically, but never supervised construction, especially at a, you know, resort hotel kind of scale. Trained the staff, which was basically village folks, to, you know, really a 3-star kind of customer service without, obviously they didn't know English, but everything else in terms of making beds, cleaning loos, serving food, you know, managing guests, checking them in, out, etc. So I think laundry, everything that a typical resort does.
And you put in your own money in this?
Yes, I put in a fair bit of money in this, and so did the folks I kind of partnered with. Luckily managed to get all of that out by the end of it. But yeah, it was in a way 2 years wasted, but it was again 2 years of fun. I think building something, and this was pretty remote, it was like 30 kilometers even from it was fun. I think and was involved in everything, right from branding the place to building it.
Was it like you felt that this doesn't have that kind of scope to grow, like in terms?
No, I was actually very bullish. So my idea was that I set this up, run this to understand this better, and then offer this more as a service to a lot of mom and pop resorts across the country, right? So I saw a lot of resorts, like for example in Corbett, which are really well located, etc. But you know, they're not managed well because the founders started with a lot of passion, but have either grown old or, you know, got bored, or they're not able to pull in the kind of customers they should. I obviously had my network in travel. I knew every tour operator. I knew how to sell travel, you know, so I got all that on board. So the idea was to actually take them over, you know, improve them in terms of, you know, quality, training of staff, in terms of the whole experience, but keep it to the very outdoorsy kind of experience, right? Those kind of places. So no, the idea was to actually scale that, yeah. But then, you know, since this didn't work out, I said, let me then kind of go back to what I know best, which is the internet. And so I did that for a couple of years. And then after, that's when I started looking at coming back to the internet space.
So how did you discover Truly Madly?
Yeah, so I think what I did first was, since I'd been pretty much off the grid for a couple of years, obviously the internet space had kind of evolved in that time. I started talking to younger founders, and I started actually investing, and more again to learn what is happening, how are things, what is the quality of, you know, founders, what are the kind of problems that they are solving, etc. So I started, you know, just as a small angel investor, very, very small amounts, just to more get back into the thick of things. And then, you know, started looking at internet businesses, older internet businesses, which hadn't really evolved with time, right? So, or just look at old internet businesses where one could, you know, with all the new tech, with, you know, social media was just about happening at that point in time, how to use that as a marketing channel, how to use that as a distribution channel. So I looked at jobs, I looked at real estate, travel I didn't want to do, looked at matrimony. So those were some of the things I was looking at and seeing, hey, how can these be disrupted again, right? One round of disruption had happened 10 years ago. They're obviously up for disruption again. And that's when I met Rahul, who used to be with me at MakeMyTrip. He was one of our product managers. He was looking at, so he'd left MakeMyTrip too. He'd started a QSR chain called American Hot Dogs, and he was doing rolls and stuff like that. And I got introduced to Hitesh, who had just exited Let's Buy back then. And, you know, I was discussing the thesis with them of looking at existing businesses which are ripe for like disruption. So that's when we went through a lot of these businesses, went back and forth, met many times. And that's when we realized that, hey, matrimony seems like kind of interesting. It's not been disrupted. They're still matching people based on caste, creed, and religion. There is no verification at all. I heard horror stories personally from some people who I knew of, the kind of people they'd met on these matrimony sites. So actually the original idea was really to disrupt online matrimony by offering verification which social media allowed you to do back then. And by doing real matching, right? Algorithmic matching versus just, like I said, matching based on caste, creed, and religion. So that's what we set out to do. But then, from a business perspective, realized that, hey, matrimony kind of plateaus out over time. LTVs are fairly low. You get people in when they are 26, throw them out when they are 26, 27, 28, and therefore LTVs are low. And that's when we said, hey, maybe dating is a much larger play versus matrimony. And then we evolved to dating. But yeah, the original idea was to really disrupt online matrimony.
How did the venture get off the ground? Like, how did you go about finalizing what is the concept, and how did you come up with the name and all of that? Like,
I think Rahul and Hitesh were very keen on working on the matching algorithm, right? So they had this view that we can match much better, right, based on people's hobbies, interests, their social graph, etc. And it came from personal experience, right? Rahul had a lot of cousins, younger cousins in Delhi and Bombay, and some guys would come back from the US who wanted to meet new people, but they did not know, and they just wanted to meet to kind of date or just to get to know people, right? How do you kind of match with each other? One, there's no platform to do it. And second, even if there's a platform, how do you know that he or she is the right person for me? So I think they were coming from that kind of perspective. And both of them had some personal experience, about this. And my personal experience was more on the verification side, where I remember there was this neighbor. There's just one example, and there are many, many more. There's this neighbor, a dermatologist. So, from a good educated family, and they were still looking for somebody for her on a matrimonial site, right? And I remember she met two people, and both of them had incorrectly mentioned what they... So one guy said he's an MBA. He'd done like some 1 week course in Miami at some college or whatever. And the other guy was a total fraud, like nothing about him was right. And that kind of struck me. And then when I started, talking to more and more people, I realized that this is like the biggest problem that matrimonial sites have, that a lot of people, actually 30% of men on matrimonial sites back then were married men, right? Who had no business being on matrimonial sites. And, it's fairly easy now, you realize to kind of weed out such people, right? But nobody was doing anything about it. So I think I was coming in more from that perspective, and it seemed like an ideal kind of marriage, if I was to use that term, that, hey, they wanted to solve one part of the problem. I was keen on solving the other part of the problem, very, very passionate about it. And that's how we kind of gelled and kind of got together. And that's, like I said, we wanted to disrupt matrimony first, but then realize that, hey, dating is much bigger. So that's what we then started working on. We used to work out of a cafe, out of a Costa cafe, opposite my house in Gurgaon. There was, Truly Madly Deeply by Savage Garden playing one day. And it immediately kind of struck me that, hey, this has to be the name. And luckily, both of them kind of agreed. That's how the name came about. We worked on it, Rahul, especially on the product side in the early days, whiteboarding the entire thing. And then we also knew, and Rahul's actually a techie turned product guy, which is kind of useful, but we still needed somebody to code. And Rahul was extremely fussy in terms of the kind of person he wants. So we actually spent, I think, 4 months looking for this person. But I think, fortunately, what that 4 months did is that we whiteboarded the concept to pretty much looked at every aspect of of what the final product would be, And I think once this person joined, it just made it so much easier because we were able to pretty much give him every screen, every page for him to code. And that okay. I think that's what helped us launch very, very quickly also.
How did you verify, say, somebody is actually married or not and stuff like that?
We built like an algorithm. It was like a verification score. We asked you, see, unlike a lot of other dating apps where you just log on and then you are swiping based on looks and location, my personal belief was that, you know, we were the first dating app in India. Women are obviously a very, very important segment. I mean, there is no dating without, you know, women on it. My belief was that since this will be their first experience with online dating, we need to ensure that they get a good experience, they get a clean experience, right? And therefore, it was very important to keep at least the married men out. You know, you might not like the guy you chat with or you see or whatever, but at least, you know, he's verified, he's not married, etc. So I think that was very core to what we believed in. And that's luckily sustained even with the new management that's running Truly Madly now, who I've handed over the business to. That core tenet still is very, very strong in the team, right? So we built something called a trust score. But, you know, you had to provide certain information. We checked your face. That time you could check people's Facebook profiles. They could give you permission. You could check the Facebook profile. We could check your status on Facebook. We even checked if your Facebook profile itself was genuine. So say you're a married guy and just to get onto Truly Madly, you created another profile. We would catch that out, right? We would see how old is your profile. How many friends do you have? Do you have an active newsfeed or not? Then people above a certain age, we would actually go into Facebook and see if there are pictures with Mangal Sutras or pictures around a Havan kind of thing, etc. So we were able to do a lot of that. So we gave you a trust score, but we kind of gamified it. We made it interesting. The higher your trust score, the more matches you got, the higher your trust score. Women tended to like you more because they knew that, hey, his trust score is higher than the other guy. So we communicated a lot of that. And that, I think, really worked for us well in the early days. At least it set us apart, right? And I think that's helped us endure also. We're obviously nowhere even close to a Tinder. But it's the only dating business which has survived on its own steam because of the early positioning around safety and security. So women really love us. I think that's stood the test of time now.
Okay. And did you raise funds for this?
Yeah, we raised funds. So we raised a small seed round in the early days from K Capital. Hmm. And then we went on to raise around $5 million from Helion and K Capital. We raised money for the business.
And what was the monetization plan?
Yeah, so in the early days, I think, and that time again, it was the heydays again of internet investing. I think we were advised and we ourselves felt that, hey, let's build the community first. Let's scale this up. Let it be free for the longest time, and we'll figure out about monetization later. We obviously had plans on how we would be able to monetize this, but I think then again the market kind of slumped and went down, and then every investor. And while our metrics were really good in terms of engagement, in terms of growth, etc., in terms of daily matches that we were making. I think investors, the feedback we got from investors, hey, this is all great. But, you need to start making money. So then we again went back to the drawing board. So we developed certain products within the app, which we would be able to monetize. Some of them didn't work, but some of them, like Truly Madly Select, which is still around, which is the biggest way in which we monetize.
Help me understand better.
So essentially what happens on Truly Madly and most other dating apps is that only if there's a mutual match do you get to chat with a person, right? Which means that if I've liked someone and she's kind of liked me back, it's only then. So if I've liked someone and she hasn't liked me back, you can't communicate with the person, right? So what we used to do is that if both of you have been matched by us, but you haven't got a like back, we could still give you an opportunity to send that message, right? And sometimes sending that message is the stimulus that the other person needs to kind of, you know, reply to you or like you back, etc. But I think we understood the Indian use case where we realized that most guys in India just say hi, hello, or you have a lovely name, or you have nice eyes, or something like that. And then, you know, if a girl looks at her feed, she sees 20 highs and hellos only, right? It's not really moving the needle. So what we would do is we would actually recommend what they should say. I think that was a big game. So based on your both their social profile, so if both of you liked Arijit Singh, then you would say, hey, why don't you talk about Arijit Singh's latest song? I mean, it was all algorithmically done. But I think that really got conversations going. We obviously tried a bunch of other monetization things, which didn't work, where we were, we started matching people based on events that they like. We started organizing dates for people and getting them coupons from restaurants, etc. So a lot of that stuff we experimented with, which didn't really scale or work. But I think Truly Madly Select is something that has, stayed on. And that's the way the company still monetizes.
Okay. Do you think your thesis on Truly Madly was incorrect? Because, you have one line of thought of Tinder, which is making it super easy to swipe and meet. And then you have the other line of thought where you want 100% trust to be built up first. And obviously Tinder has like blown up and also. So
Yeah. No, absolutely. So, can't even defend the thesis. No, the thesis was, I think we were trying to do what's right. What we felt is right from a woman's perspective. And that's what they said. So all the research we did, even when you read between the lines, that's what they said. But eventually when we went back to them, they said, hey, we are smart enough. We'll figure out, who the guy is. If you have to block him, we'll block him. Don't worry about it, right? We'll take care of ourselves. I think we kind of misjudged that. And we built this entire thing on, all verified profiles. We actually did compatibility matching, which again, people didn't care about. At the end of the day, people cared more about looks than anything else. So from that perspective, yes, the thesis was wrong. But having said that, Truly Madly is still around and it's known. So there is obviously a market for this slightly serious use case. So now a lot of our customers, or rather a lot of the Truly Madly customers, are people in their, between the 25 to 28 kind of range who are not looking at getting married immediately, but this is like the first step towards matrimony, right? And that's, an interesting niche which they are playing in. Revenues have doubled since I've moved on. Actually, the internal joke is that the company is doing so much better since I've moved on, in a way that, everyone else launched in India just like Tinder, right? And everyone else is also pretty much shut down, right? But Truly Madly is still out there profitable. They've actually just raised a round of funding, which they'll announce in the next few weeks. In hindsight, yes, we could have gone the Tinder way, but then could we have beaten Tinder at its own game? Could be another question, right? So I think in a way, it's good that we kind of stuck to this and built not a very big business, but still built a decent business, out of date.
What was your learning from that stint? Like learning which would have helped you now with Bulbul?
Yeah, so I think, a lot of what I've done at Bulbul actually came out of some of the experiments we did on live streaming, on video. These are things we tried out at Truly Madly, actually, right? So we got guys to post video profiles to, because there's obviously in India there are far more guys than girls on dating platform, right? So how does a guy stand out? So we got guys to do video profiles, so to make them seem more interesting. We got guys to go live, right? So guys playing with a soccer ball, somebody's doing shayari, somebody's playing the guitar, somebody's reading out poetry, stuff like that. So I think one was just from a product and tech perspective, I think it gave me a fairly decent understanding of how video, and this is 4 years ago, right? When video wasn't the hot commodity that it is today. This is pretty much around the time Jio was launching. So Jio wasn't the force it is today. But it gave me insight that, hey, this is where the market is kind of moving. Video is interesting and exciting. And then, I did a lot of research once we realized that we won't be able to take on Tinder at its own game. That maybe there's a use case in smaller towns for, maybe not for dating as the word connotes, but you know, everyone wants to be in a relationship. Everyone wants needs companionship. So I, you know, started traveling to smaller towns, getting insights from there, talking to customers from smaller towns. I think it's during that journey that I figured out this use case for video and video selling, etc. But that is more, you know, tactical. I think from a learning, you know, the big learning obviously was that, you know, there was this thesis that we had, which is around what's the right thing for the customer. But I think it was a fairly superficial thesis, right? It was probably what we also wanted to hear as entrepreneurs, that, you know, women want verified profiles and they want that security. We had tons of security features on Truly Madly, right? Women could block profiles, they could report profiles, all that sort of stuff. But eventually, you know, they didn't care about that. You know, everyone's can take care of themselves from that perspective. So I think you have to read between the lines and read far deeper when you're looking, trying to glean consumer insights, and not try to fit your thesis or narrative with what you're hearing from consumers, right? I think a lot of us tend to kind of do that and continue doing that. So I think that, to my mind, was the bigger learning.
Did it make you more humble, like, you know, realizing that maybe your ego caused you to form that kind of thesis and not see the reality? Did you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So if you listen to, I mean, I don't know where you can, but if you listen to some of my interviews at the beginning of Truly Madly, they're fairly bombastic, right, about taking on Tinder, being number one, you know, we are the India app before it became fashionable to say you are an India app. So we were saying all those things. But eventually it didn't pan out like that, right? I mean, Tinder has just taken the market, and rightfully so, right? I think they have a far, far, far superior product than anyone else out there. And so, no, absolutely. I think you have to listen to, I think, all stakeholders. You have to listen to customers. You have to even listen to a lot of, I think, our colleagues internally were also telling us that, hey, this is the way to go, you know, keep it open. But I think by then it was too late. I think we got that positioning and Tinder was growing. And I realized that we won't be able to, even if we did, you know, what Tinder does, we probably won't be able to, you know, take them on. And that's when we hunkered down and said, hey, okay, let's focus on what we've now. Mm-hmm. It's not as if this is not working, right? People are paying us for verified profile. Mm-hmm. Yes, it will be a much smaller market, but things will change eventually. And that's what's happened, right? I think, like I said, revenues kind of doubled because more and more people are seeing the value in what we do. It'll still never probably be as big as a Tinder in the near future, but you never know. It's growing really well.
So tell me about that decision to move on. How did you find a successor? What was the trigger that, okay, this is not the, like, this is not what I want to do anymore?
Yeah, so it was, for me, it was honestly more an opportunity cost. You know, I realized that also I was, you know, one, I think I realized that maybe it wasn't even my problem to solve, right? I was married with kids, right?
Okay,
and here
okay.
I was solving a problem which wasn't even my problem. Though I spent, having said that, I spent a lot of time at campuses, at call centers, etc., with a lot of young people. And that's why we were still able to build a product which kind of at least to some extent worked for them. But you can only do it to a certain extent, right? You can't do it beyond. So I think that was one thing which was very apparent. Maybe, you know, I just wasn't willing to kind of see the light. So I think that kind of happened. Rahul and Hitesh. Hitesh left early. Rahul also wanted to leave. Basically, I was left running the company, which was fine. I was kind of happy to do that with a small team. But I really was. And then in meetings, I realized that I was contributing more from a strategic level, but I wasn't really contributing on product and on daily kind of stuff, right? I just couldn't make that difference anymore. And I could make that difference in the early days. So I was kind of losing out on that. But I was still very passionate about Truly Madly, not just because it is something I'd started, etc. But I still, even today, believe that there is a space, you know, for something like Truly Madly. So I never want... So actually, our investors, especially K, Sasha Mirchandani, used to tell me once it was pretty apparent that it won't scale the way it was being run. He said, hey, why don't you shut this down? You know, it didn't run. We still believe in you as an entrepreneur. Let's do something else, right? And actually, he gave me a bunch of ideas. He and Naveen, who's his partner, They gave me a bunch of ideas and stuff. They said, we'll still kind of fund you, you know, just move on. But I think there was, you know, that bit of obstinacy that a lot of entrepreneurs have to not kind of give up. So that was there. But yeah, I wasn't obstinate enough to think that I could still run it. I think I realized that, accepted that. And then Snehal, who now runs Truly Madly, he was actually one of our first product managers. And he was our first product manager. And then he'd gone on to do his own startup, which kind of got sold. Then he joined another internet venture, you know, doing stuff for them. So then I kind of got him back. And I said, hey, you know, you are still single, you're still young. You understand the core philosophy of the business. I'm still willing to, you know, fund it myself personally because I believe there is still some meat in this business. Why don't you come and run it, right? And in parallel, we'd also started separately an app for the LGBT community called Delta with another founder who kind of also moved on because I helped them raise some money, but then they just couldn't build the business beyond that. And Amit, who was the co-founder there and the CTO, so I got him together with Snehal and told them that, hey guys, this is the opportunity. Both of you understand the dynamics of this business. You know, give it a shot. And both of them really did believe in it. And obviously, I gave them equity, etc. I funded the business for another year myself personally. And of course, they've, you know, thankfully. So that's really how I decided to move on. You know, Bulbul is an idea I'd kind of explored, you know, 3 years back when I was still at Truly Madly, but I'd put it on the back burner. So because it was just too early that at that point in time. So then once I kind of handed over the reins to them and I knew that they will kind of continue with the business because now they had enough skin in the game. Like one, they were passionate about the space. And second, they obviously had enough equity. We recapitalized the company and did all of that. And yeah, now, like I said, they're running it successfully. It's a profitable company. They've just raised a small round of money for the next phase of growth. So things are good there. Yeah.
So you said that around 2017 only you had the idea for Bulbul. Mm. What was that idea?
Yeah, so what I noticed was that, you know, if you look at small town India, they, unlike the very intent-driven solitary experience that you and I have on an Amazon or a Flipkart, small town India still loves to go out and shop, right? People go out together, right? It's not people don't go out alone, right? Even during the weekday, if somebody's in Indore is going out to the market, they'll, you know, family, they'll go with family, they'll go with friends. And it's a very interactive experience. You know, people talk to each other, discuss with each other, comment, be very personal, very into each other's lives. Care, ye lipstick tere pe jach rahi hai ki nahi, ye parda tere drawing room mein achha lagega ki nahi, that kind of stuff, right? And then there's a lot of interactivity with the shopkeeper, you know, saab andar aa jao, khareedna mat, dekh lo sirf, you know, and we like to touch and feel products. So I noticed that whenever I traveled and I was hanging out at a lot of these places, and I said there has to be a far more real way of selling versus, like I said, the solitary intent-driven experience you have on e-commerce in India, right? If you look at e-commerce in India, I think, you know, catalog, it's a catalog, right? Catalog selling has been in the US for maybe 100 years. Then Craigslist came and disrupted that. Amazon obviously came and disrupted it further. Amazon India has copied Amazon. Flipkart has copied Amazon. So it's all the same, right? So if you are urban, English speaking, even if you're semi-urban, highly literate, you know exactly what you want. Amazon, Flipkart are a great place to go, right? You go and search and you get out. But when it comes to, you know, discovery, none of them are very friendly when it comes to discovery. And Indians like to browse. Indians like to window shop. Everyone does, actually, for that matter. So I think that was really the germ of the idea. And I think I remember coming back from one of the trips, got a bunch of girls from office at Truly Madly ready to kind of go live. That time there was Facebook Live had just started. So we bought products from the market and we built this little campaign saying, hey, you know, you got a date night and what will you, how will you accessorize yourself? Truly Madly is bringing you like a session live with some experts and, you know, stuff like that. The idea was really to gauge interactivity, not really to sell stuff. But surprisingly, we actually managed to sell everything we got on, right? Because there was tons of interactivity. People were asking a lot of questions. They were asking us to bring the earring closer to the camera, show us the inside of the bag, whether it's, you know, stuff like that. So that was pretty exciting. But I think back then, I did not have the confidence to pull it off, in the sense that I did not have a co-founding team which could, supplement the skills that I had, right? I realized this will be an ops heavy business. I realized it will be a tech and product heavy business. And obviously, I still understand product, but obviously, clearly not, ops is not something that, comes kind of naturally to me. And then obviously, video was still, it was very early days for video back then. Jio was just about kind of, it's still, like I said, wasn't the force it is now. I think live streaming video tech was kind of hard to come by. I said, hey, maybe this is too early. So I just kept it on the back burner. And then once I decided to exit Truly Madly, that's when Atit, who's my co-founder and who I've known for the last 5-6 years through his various startups. And then he was with Seth Partners as an investor last. He'd left Seth and he'd come to me with a bunch of ideas. And I showed him all the pilots I'd done, the business plan. I had everything ready, actually. I showed it to him. He got super excited. We, again, threadbare the idea, whiteboarded it, went back to some of the smaller towns, met with customers. That's when we decided to, that, hey, this is what we want to do next.
So Bulbul is pure live streaming. It's essentially like a live streaming shopping experience.
It's both live and pre-recorded videos, but it's all video, video commerce. It has live and pre-records both.
What is the way in which you see this evolving? What do you see as like a 5-year evolution of Bulbul?
Yeah, so I think we look at it like a 3-way kind of marketplace, right? Of these influencers or micro influencers. Of vendors, suppliers, manufacturers, D2C brands, and consumers, right? I think in the future, we should be a credible platform and a credible brand, which people trust. They trust the influencers who are there. They trust the brands that they can buy. Eventually, an influencer should be able to directly, go to a brand and say, hey, or a brand should be able to approach an influencer saying, hey, you are known, you're for, say, selling apparel. I sell apparel. Why don't you promote my products, right? And we then take care of payments, logistics, all of that stuff. But that's still some time in the future. Currently, we obviously curate and control the entire experience. But that's where we see ourselves eventually heading towards. Where anyone who's a great content creator, anyone who can sell on video, and it could be a manufacturer himself, right? If I make belt cushion covers in Panipat, I should be able to make my own video because I understand the product well. And if I'm confident in front of the camera, I should be able to make my own video, put it up on Bulbul, or put it up on my Instagram, and then Bulbul enables the entire transaction.
Tell me about your fundraise journey also.
Yeah, so early last year, we got into the Surge program, which is run by Sequoia for early stage startups. It's an exceptional program, probably among the most unique programs in the world in terms of, the quality of the investor first, which is Sequoia, quality of other founders, and just the quality of people they let you kind of network with, interface with, content, sessions, etc. So we were the first company in Surge. First company that they kind of signed on. So we raised some money then.
You already had revenue at that stage?
No, we were actually didn't even have a product. It was just a concept. It was just like a PPT. So it was Atit and me, and we'd got Sanjay over to head technology then from Mintra. So we got into Surge, raised $2 million from Sequoia, from Surge and from a fund called Leo Capital. And then we launched the product in March, then raised some more money from a fund called CDH, which is a Chinese fund, and from Sequoia and Leo again. And we've just concluded another fundraise with InfoEdge and again Sequoia and Leo. So yeah, we've That's pretty much been our fundraise. So we've raised around $15 million to date. And yeah, that's been the fundraising journey so far.
And the fund is the funding is for what? Like, is it for building a team or is it for marketing?
No, yes, I think the team is in place. It's more to, I think, build this network of influencers out at scale. I think we've proven that we can do that. I think we've proven that we know how to sell through videos, how to create content. I think all of those tick boxes are done. The team is completely in place. We're not really hiring anymore now. We've set up a call center, except a couple of hires here and there. The all positions are kind of done. So yeah, this is for our next kind of phase of growth and really setting up this differentiated marketing sales channel of selling via these influencers.
What does the app look like? Does it look like an Amazon app where you have products listed and you click on a product and instead of a photo, you see a video? Is that what it looks like? Or
no, it has. It's more like a GIF. So you'll see these big windows with products, with a host, with a slight description. And when you click on that, you get into a video. And in the video itself, you can buy the product. You don't need to kind of come back to a catalog or whatever. So it's all enabled on the video itself. You can buy and then it's a typical e-commerce flow till you exit, you've completed your purchase.
You also use the same videos on other like YouTube, Insta, etc. Or are they exclusively on Bulbul only?
We use them off app also now.
So that in a way is also like a content marketing strategy.
Yes.
So what next for Sachin? You know, I mean, you are, I think, somebody who gets restless after every few years. And, you know, what do you think will happen a couple of years down the line once you feel Bulbul is stable? What do you think will be the next phase of life for you?
It does sound like that. Make My Trip was 10 years. Truly Madly was 5 years, not short by any stretch of imagination, not short stints by any stretch of imagination. I think this is, pretty much hopefully my last gig. So I think, one has to make it count from that perspective. So that kind of positive pressure is there. But what I'm doing is great. It's super exciting. I get to work with very, very young people. My co-founder is 32. I'm 48, so obviously it keeps me extremely young and agile. And we are in an interesting space, right? It's not only e-commerce, but it's also content. It's also video, which is like the next big thing. It's also about, the larger Indian population, which is coming online. So it's all all converging very well, right? It's all exciting. All the pieces are very, very exciting. I think the idea is to scale this, grow this, make this pretty much a third front to an Amazon or a Flipkart, because the audience is a very video first audience, right? They're not like guys like you and me who first consume the written content. These guys, the first piece of content these guys have consumed is the video content, right? And that too in local languages. Like we don't have any English content on the app. So I think it's at a place where each element is kind of exciting, and that's what keeps me kind of excited. I don't see anything beyond this, at least in the near future. This is what I hopefully want to continue kind of doing.
And what is it that you are currently seeking as learning? Like, what kind of learning are you seeking? And I mean, speaking from experience, most entrepreneurs are essentially seeking to learn, and being an entrepreneur is like a outcome of that desire to learn.
I mean, I don't know if they truly believe that or they just say that to sound deep. So I don't know how much of that is genuinely true. No, and I think I'm looking at, I think learning is an outcome, right? For me, it's about building a successful business. For me, it's about building something endearing for the team that is working on this and has put a lot of effort into it. And obviously something that consumers find useful, right? Obviously, along the way, I learn how to build a bigger and better organization. I learn insights into consumers that probably are not second nature to me, sitting here in the city. How does... And I've learned so much, right? How do local language users How do people in smaller towns, how do they think? What do they look for? You know, so I think those learnings will kind of happen along the way. Obviously, you become, you know, with experience, you become a little more resilient to outside forces, whether it's, you know, investors or what people say or what people will think, etc. Those things kind of matter to you less. So I think for me, the big thing is building this into something which is successful, yeah, profitable, successful, and scalable. What I learn along the way, let's see what I learn. Yeah, I mean, one obviously keeps learning.
Who are some of the people that inspire you? You know, like real life people, not like people that you read about in books.
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm not, I mean, I don't want to sound, you know, it's not as if I'm not easily inspired or something. I think there are some people who are, you know, I don't have a mentor, right? You know, but there are people who kind of I look up to, people who I seek advice from. But I think real inspiration, this might sound a little cliche, but it's true. I think for me, real inspiration comes from, you know, small kind of businessmen. It could be, you know, there's, I came across this fruit seller, right, in Malaysia, in Penang. It's an island north of Malaysia, and this guy comes at a particular time every day, and he cuts fruit, and he does it on a cycle, right? And you know, he's wearing a glove. He cuts each fruit with a certain amount of precision. Each kind of fruit is cut to the same size. He doesn't touch the product at all. So he's wearing a glove, and he cuts it on his glove, and then he slides it into a packet. Through the glove only, right? Now, and I've seen him do it day after day, every day, for a very long period of time, and the process never changes, right? And I think those are some of the things I think about, right? Those are things which are very, very inspiring for me to, hey, just show up, you know, be the last man standing kind of thing, but show up every day. I think I find inspiration in that. But, you know, Deep and Rajesh, who run Make My Trip, Sanjeev Bikchandani, who was on our board at Make My Trip and now is on our board at Bulbul. These are people I know immediately and personally, and I seek them out for advice, for help, etc. And they are truly inspirational, right? Like Deep's been doing this now for 20 years, you know, day in and day out. And I think it takes a lot, right, to kind of do this. Sanjeev's been doing this for longer. And to me, I think that is a big source of inspiration that, hey, you know, keep plugging away, right? And I think that keep plugging away is like a big theme for me, that just keep doing what you're doing. Be the last man standing, you know, that's important.
What is it that makes a Sanjeev Bikchandani invest in somebody? Like, what does he look for? Is it like he looks at the quality of the team, or is it like they do a numbers analysis and look at the market opportunity and stuff like that? Or
yeah, I don't think I've gotten into his mind to know how he thinks. But what I've seen on the surface is that he likes ideas which are very grounds up. He likes ideas which are for the masses, and not niche kind of businesses. At least that's my reading. I mean, he might have made investments which might seem a little niche today, but I think overall that's what he kind of looks at. He has obviously a stellar investment team, which is run by Kitty Agarwal, and she's, I think, more the nuts and bolts kind of person, and I think he relies on her a lot. But I think Sanjeev really likes businesses which are more... you know, where the market is huge, where the consumer market is huge, which is addressing the larger Indian kind of population. I think he likes, from what I've seen, he loves those kind of businesses. And obviously founders then who are, you know, either who have some experience or who are flexible. I think that's important one for him. From whatever I've seen, he doesn't like people who are kind of stuck in their ways or seem to know it all. I think he likes people who are a little flexible, who like to listen, and who really value... Because he is not only an investor, I mean, he is obviously a very successful investor now, but he's also, you need to value him for the entrepreneur that he is. And I, when I think of seeking advice from him, it is about that part of the learning one can get from him, which is more around the business, entrepreneurship, etc., versus his inputs as an investor.
Mm-hmm. And what makes Surge select a company? Like, what is their way of choosing which company to back?
Yeah, I think they look at the classic thing. They look at the team. They look at the business idea. They look at the addressable market. So I don't think they look at things very differently, but they just have a sharper sense given the collective experience of the team on what will work, what will not work, what will scale versus probably a lot of other guys. Because they've seen very closely businesses both in Southeast Asia and India, which a lot of Indian investors have seen stuff here, right? Because of Shailendra in Southeast Asia and because of the rest of the Surge team in India, I think they have a very good sense of how both markets work, what will scale, what will not. So I think that's the advantage that they have as a team. And that's why the Surge program is so successful.
So Surge plays the role of an angel investor, like they would invest in you even before you have an MVP or something.
Yeah, it depends. I think they've done it in some cases. I don't think that's the norm, but they do look at fairly early stage businesses. Yes. I mean, they've invested in companies which are 2-3 years old also, but those companies are still small companies and now ready for the next kind of stage of growth.
Well, ladies and gents, that was Sachin Bhatia, the founder of Bulbul. We're sure his incredible journey has not only inspired you, but has also intrigued that curious brain of yours about what live streaming of a product actually means. For those who are not familiar with Sachin's online shopping methodology, head to Bulbul TV now, and while you explore the website, suit yourself to some exciting offers and deals. Happy shopping!
If you like the Founder Thesis podcast, then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.
This was an HD Smartcast original. HD Smartcast.
Log on to hdsmartcast.com to listen to more such podcasts.